sitting up nice and tall. You can open your eyes, you can close your eyes. And just letting the busyness of the day go. Letting whatever is coming next go. And bringing your focus right to the crown of your head. And taking your time scanning down your body. And just relaxing and softening wherever you can. So just feeling the sensations, not thinking about them. And once you scan all the way down your body, then start to scan back up. Keeping your physical form relaxed, but brightening the quality of your mind as you scan up. So you're clearing away any clouds in the mind. Let your attention rest on your breath. It can be the rhythm of the breath as it moves the chest or the belly or the tip of the nose. And you'll want to pick the location where your awareness feels clear and bright, but not so you're feeling pressure in your eyes or your forehead where you're having to focus too much. feel your body tensing, relax your focus. Soften the focus. It's still crisp and clear, you're just not holding as tightly. Find your breath really clear and brightly for the last few moments. Ending the meditation on a bright, clear awareness. And then once you have that, releasing your focus, expanding your attention into the whole body, the weight of your body on the floor or the seat. And expand into the room around you, feeling the cool air, hearing the sounds. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes, start to move, and make a dedication. Welcome back, Bernardo. All right, so we are on class 5 of What's Next, a deep dive into death and rebirth. And today is Wednesday, May 23rd, 2018. And so tonight we're going to talk about bardo beings. So before we start jumping into that, we're going to do our review so that we know the original text that we're studying and who wrote it, and then the commentary that we're studying. So who knows who wrote Death and the Realms of Existence? Who knows what Death and the Realms of Existence is in Tibetan? I'm thinking Jenny. It's kind of a hard one. So say Chu Nungpa Zu.
Chu Nungpa Zu.
Chu Nungpa Zu.
Chu Nungpa Zu.
Okay, so that's the Tibetan. And then the Sanskrit, you all know, is Abhidharma Kosha. I don't know if we've been going over the Tibetan every week. So the Abhidharma Kosha is written by who?
Master Vasubandhu.
Yep, Master Vasubandhu. And when did he live?
350?
Mm-hmm. Around 350 A.D. And so Abhidharma Kosha translates to Treasure House of Higher Knowledge, which I love. All of the translations for the text are so beautiful. And then the commentary, who remembers what that's called?
Illumination on the Path to Freedom.
Yep, Illumination. Or a lamp on the path to freedom. And anybody know what that is in Tibetan? It's Tarlam Selje. Say Tarlam Selje.
Tarlam Selje.
And who wrote this commentary?
Gyalwa Gendun Drupa.
Mm-hmm. Also known as?
The first Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm. The first Dalai Lama. So he was a student of Jetsun Kapa, who started the Galupa lineage. And his dates were approximately 1391 to 1474, the first Dalai Lama's. Okay. So, let's go ahead and start jumping into the Bardo. So, all of this is from the Abhidharma Kosha commentary that we just mentioned. So, say Bardo.
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 And so what a bardo is, it's the state a being is in between death and birth. And the bardo is the state, and then the being's name when they're in that state is a bardoa. So you may have heard both terms. I think sometimes they're used kind of interchangeably to both mean bardo, but technically bardo is the state and then the being is called a bardoa. And then the following three are synonyms for bardo being. So one is the one I just mentioned, say bardoa.
Bardoa.
And then bar C, say bar C.
Bar C.
And that's the life in it translates literally to the life in between. And then say Drisa.
Drisa.
Which is smell eater. And we'll go into that so it'll make as much sense as it can. And who's heard teachings on the bardo before? Lama Mi taught it.
Yeah.
And that's mostly the ones that I've heard too. And apparently there's many corrupt teachings. That's what Geshe Michael, who taught these courses, which is what I'm teaching, that's what he mentions in this class, is that there's a lot of corrupt teachings on the bardo. And that this teaching, what we're going from here, you can read it all in the readings, which are online if you want access. I can tell you the website. So this teaching is from the original text, and it's very accurate. So that's really important to know, because we want to be carrying on a pure lineage, because it was taught by an enlightened being originally, the Buddha, and it's been passed down purely up until this point, so it would be a shame if it was at our generation that we mix something up or that we change it because it's not popular or it makes us uncomfortable or we don't quite get it yet or you know something like that. So keeping it pure is really important. So that's why we talk about where all of the teachings come from. Because it would kind of just be like we were making up our own religion. And if we're enlightened beings, maybe that would work. But I know I'm not, and so I'm not really the one to decide which teachings to share and which not, and which ones I want to kind of change. So we're going right from the traditional Tibetan, which comes down from the Buddha himself, ultimately. So it's interesting, too, because Geshe Michael talks about, especially in Tibet, there are a lot of corruptions in the teachings of the bardo. And we're among the first Americans to study Tibetan Buddhism. You know, the first, we're maybe like one of the first few generations of Americans to study Tibetan Buddhism. And so it's really great that we get to study a pure and clean lineage, a pure version of it. Because that's the version that's going to work, too. If it's changed, most likely it's not going to work. If it's going to, we just don't know yet. So it's a lot better to study directly from the source. And it's the same with teachers. And we're lucky in our center because we have trusted teachers who vet everyone that's coming in or know them, or I don't know another word for that, but kind of vouch for them. So we have teachers that we can trust. But then when we go and travel around, you don't always know who the teachers are. And like the Buddha taught, you should be skeptical of the teachings, and then in our time you should be skeptical of the teachers too, until you get to know them. So get to know that what they're teaching is true and correct, that they're who they say they are. What Geshe Michael mentions is that, this was a while ago when Tibetans were first coming over to the U.S. and starting to teach. He said that he knew one Tibetan man who hadn't studied at all and then came to America and started teaching, because Americans didn't know at that point. All of us know, but you know, we've been studying, so we can tell the difference. But it's good to check out teachers anyways. Like they say in the original text, to check them out. Traditionally, it'd be for 12 years. So what we're studying tonight are the words of the Buddha and then the first Dalai Lama explaining them. I think I already talked about this already. And there's a lot more details on this subject, but they're all in the tantric teachings. So you'll get them at that time. So continuing on with the bardo. Beings take rebirth in the bardo as bardo beings, although they have a very short lifespan. So it is a separate birth, and bardo beings are zuki. So say zuki, which means born complete, as in they arise spontaneously. And we're going to go into the proof that there are bardo beings. So, keep in mind that the bardo being is the being that's in the state between death and their next birth. So that's what we're talking about. And it's very common in Buddhism, in a debate in a monastery, to have to show good logical proof, and then that someone who's reputable also supports what you're talking about. So scriptural proof, that would be a good one for that. And then logical proof as well. And in a debate, you're also supposed to speak to the level of the person you're debating in the monastery. That's how you're supposed to debate. And I think for us, we could take that to mean anybody that we're talking to about Buddhism, whether it's at the Dharma Center or friends or family. So you speak to the level of knowledge or things that are going to make sense to them, not just saying things completely over their head that they're going to have no idea what you're talking about or may freak them out or may turn them off completely to learning about anything spiritual, that sort of thing. So you would speak at a level and with examples that they can understand and that are going to make sense to them. So you could teach them the same thing that you already know and are trying to share, but in a way that's helpful for them. And I think that one, for me, that was hard when I was first starting to study, because I'm so excited about everything and I want to share it and kind of push it on everybody. And it's not a fun thing for other people to have something, especially a whole new worldview, pushed on them. So, you know, it's like, it's totally counterproductive. I want them to be interested, but I'm pushing them away from it. So I think this is a good point to keep in mind, I know, for myself as well. Okay, so we're going to go into logical proofs of bardo as. Okay, so this is the first one we're going into. Say, drugyen.
Drugyen.
Tibetan. Dru means grain, and gyen means stream or continuum. And this first logical proof is basically just saying you can't go from a seed or grain to a plant without the seed turning into a sprout and continuing to grow. So basically, you don't have a seed in 1 second and then plant in the next second. There has to be something in between. There has to be steps that happen. It's not just seed to plant. Right? Do we all agree on that? It's just not how it works. So there has to be something in between the grain or the seed and the plant. And similarly, you could think you can't get from Sacramento to San Francisco without traveling there. So that can make a little more sense in the Bardo example that we're talking about. Like, to become a Bardoa being, you wouldn't just go from, or I'm sorry, to become into your next life, you wouldn't just go from the last moment of this life, bam, to the next moment and be in your next life. That's what this proof is saying. So it's not that you have to necessarily believe these things right now, but they are big teachings in Buddhism. And you can always shelve them and then come back to them later if it's something that maybe just doesn't make sense right now or is pushing up against some other issue that's coming up for you, something like that. So take it with a grain of salt as we're going through it and know that, okay, there's something important here and maybe I don't know what it is yet, but at a certain point I will. Or maybe I do know right now and maybe I already completely believe it. Okay, so basically, like I just said, similarly, when we die, we have to travel to the next birth. It's not that we start out in Sacramento and in the next moment we're in San Francisco. We have to travel there. And Bardo beings and the Bardo are how we travel to the next life. So it's where you travel from the place of your death to the place of your next birth. And it's interesting, well, Master Vasubandhu, he isn't proving the existence of rebirth because we've already done that in previous courses. We already went through that. So this is kind of, could be jumping. Because this is assuming that we already accept that. And we may not. And either way is okay, but ultimately, this is kind of the crux of how the whole idea with karma works, is that it carries on from moment to moment to moment. It's a continuum. So, in the previous course that we did study, Master Dharmakirti did prove rebirth. And it is logical, and it's online, the teachings and the recordings, I think, from this course that we did are on there, too. So why not just die and then immediately be reborn somewhere else? And from what Master Vasubandhu says, it just doesn't happen like that. It's a continuum, and a continuum doesn't work that way. So that one, I think we kind of have to think about on our own a little bit. Because I can tell in my mind there's some part where I'm thinking, why doesn't a continuum work that way? But I think maybe if we have time, we'll end with a meditation too. But I think if you take some time, meditate on it, think about it a little more, then it'll sink in a little bit deeper. That's how it usually goes for me when I hear the teachings and I think, wait a minute, there's something that's not quite right there. And I don't know what it is. A lot of times if you hear it verbally, it sounds like that, and then you sit down on your cushion and meditate on it, and then you're like, oh, that is completely logical. I'm not sure what happens when we're sitting up. Maybe there's just some skepticism that comes in. And then when we're alone with our mind, we relax a little more or something.
Sometimes
So we die and then we have another lifetime there, like
in the bardo, you mean?
Yeah.
We'll go into how long it is, but it's not considered another lifetime. It's kind of counted as the beginning of the next one. And we'll go into what that means a little bit later in class. But basically, yeah, we die, and then we have this time in the bardo, and then we're reborn in our next life. Yeah. Okay. Say, Chele Jumwa.
Chele
Jumwa.
Chele Jumwa.
So like we already said, you can't have a broken continuum. So why not? Why can't you have a broken continuum? Yeah, because it's not a continuum anymore. So if it stops at one point and then it starts another, it's no longer a continuum. It's not like you cut off here and then independently you show up somewhere else. It's just not possible. No more could a fully developed tree pop out of an acorn than could a person die in one place and pop up in another instantaneously. Except for what? There is one realm that we studied that does happen. I don't know about that. I don't think the emanations are considered being reborn. But I don't know if you are enlightened, that might be in this life that you wouldn't have a bardo. But that's not the one here. It's a different realm that we studied.
Davis?
The formless realm. Mm-hmm. So there's no bardo when you go to the formless realm. Why is it called the formless realm?
Because we don't have a form.
Yeah. It's just consciousness or mind. And I think we went over this in the emptiness course, but if you keep splitting the seconds down and down again and again and again, you'll never find the moment when you became a formless realm being. And it's a really powerful emptiness meditation to do that sort of meditation. So it's not even, I think what the point is here, it's not even like you're human being, and then bam, you're formless realm being, because you can't find that moment when you're formless realm being. If you keep dividing the moments smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, there's not going to be a findable exact moment where you flopped over into the formless realm. It's really, I think that meditation is really amazing. Have you done that one? Have you, Bernardo? You have, right? Okay. Have you done that one?
No. are we talking about infinitesimal, that idea?
From the word you're using, I think it sounds similar, yeah.
It's like a dot that's not really a dot. It's a point that has absolutely no...
like
weight.
Findable end.
There's no, you can zoom in on a infinitesimal dot and it would never grow bigger.
That sounds like it might be a little bit different.
Sounds like it, yeah. Well, the same concept, I think.
Yeah, so what, it might be the same.
I think where I was going with that is, you can't divide an infinite decimal dot because it almost doesn't exist. It's not something that is dividable.
I'm not sure. I think that might be maybe a different concept. I'd have to think about it and see how it it fits with emptiness. So the idea, I think basically the idea that this one's pointing to is that there's no, like, the emptiness of time is what it's pointing to. There's no findable moment. What it's talking about here is when you're human and then when you're a formless realm being. So it's talking about the emptiness of time where you're splitting the time smaller and smaller and smaller, and there's not going to be any point where you split the time one last time and then you find, you know, there's nothing there. There's always going to be something smaller that you can divide in half. Maybe that's the same as what you're saying.
Yeah, I think
or similar. Yeah. So the point of that is that it's that things aren't solidly, I don't know if solidly is the right word, but things aren't existing exactly the way we think they are. There's not a findable point where, you know, like I think this is the table right here, and it's only a table, and everybody would see it as a table. It's not like that. It's an object I'm placing a label on, and then other beings place different labels on this, like a small ant sees this differently. A dog comes in here, sees it differently. So even different people, if you're, I don't know where you would be living where you wouldn't know what a table was, but maybe you call it something different. Maybe you think of it as something else. So it's the fact that anything, that it's not self-existently the way it is, and then that applies to us as well. So that's why at a certain point we could find ourselves in one of these different realms. And according to Buddhism, we've had countless different lives, so we have been born in all of these realms. So I think I'm covering mostly what it says. But I'm starting to get us off topic. Okay. So then Master Vasubandhu, he goes into a great example, and this is somebody debating him and saying, they're debating the idea of continuum that we're talking about. And they're saying, the example they're using is, they say my color and shape can continue in a mirror at a distance of 100 feet. You could have a continuum that stops there and then continues somewhere over there. And so what they're getting at is that there's nothing going on between them and the mirror. Their image continues after they're looking in the mirror, and then they walk around the back of the mirror and they come back, and their reflection is in the mirror again without a continuum. So they're saying your continuum idea doesn't make sense. Because I look in the mirror and I see my reflection there, and then I walk around the back of the mirror, my reflection's not there, I come back again and it's back without a continuum. So this is their debate, which seems lacking to me, but that's the debate. So Master Vasubandhu has to address this objection. And he says it's not like you are in the mirror. So the mirror is occupying the space over here, and then you're occupying this space over here. Two physical entities can't occupy the same physical space at the same time. So it's not that you are your reflection. And he says that's not your continuum in that mirror. It's colors and shapes showing up in the glass. And then he goes into the cause of you is the you of the moment before, and the cause of you in the next moment is the you in this moment. So each moment is causing the next, and each previous is causing the present. And it's the thing in the mirror is just a reflection. It's not your continuum. So the example that this person is giving is invalid. So mainly, I And ultimately, when we're talking about the previous moment causing the present moment causing the next moment, over and over and over and over, the moment that we stop seeing ourselves as one kind of being and start seeing ourselves as another kind of being, it's just a shift in our perception. And we have shifts in our perception all the time. And then if we believe the teachings on emptiness and we see how they work in our life together with karma, so things are available to be anything and we have the karmic seeds to see them a certain way, then we could see ourselves as a different type of being in the next moment. So I can look down in this moment and see hands. And then, I guess it would technically be after the bardo, I look down and I see paws. So it's just, it's a shift in perception, a shift in our projections. So all of us are empty of self-existence. We don't have to be the type of being that we are now, which is a good sign because we're in samsara, we're in suffering realm, and it's continuing over and over and over and over because we have the karmic seeds to see it that way. And one day we'll have different karmic seeds and we'll look down and we'll see ourselves as an enlightened being. We'll see a body made of light. We'll have completely different thoughts. We'll be able to, as you were mentioning, emanate and help beings in any way that they need to at any moment without even any effort. So that's the reason that emptiness and karma are important. They can be kind of, they can feel like mental gymnastics a lot, and they twist the mind. You know, it's like a mind bender. And I think that's kind of the point, is to get us out of our normal way of thinking and get us to think about things in a different way. And to me, it would make sense that if an enlightened being was talking to me, what they were saying might not be that easy for me to understand. Because they have a completely different view, and they've seen reality as it really works, as it really functions, and I see it in a mistaken way every day. I see the person cut me off in traffic and I get pissed off because I decide they are personally offending me and they got into my lane and that's not okay. When actually it could be a thousand different things. It could be they're late to work and they're worried and they're getting there as fast as they can. It could be they didn't even see me. It could be that they're an enlightened being who's here helping me deal with my anger, pointing out to me, you still have anger, you need to work with that. So it's just the ignorance and the karmic seed that pops up that is for anger, and then I decide to go along with it. Or hopefully I don't. Hopefully it comes up, and I say, okay, I see anger's coming up right now. I'm deciding to take a different path. I'm not following that today. I'm going to do whatever I have to do not to follow that. I'm going to practice patience. I'm going to think, okay, this could be an enlightened being teaching me. I don't know that they're not. It may seem far-fetched, but it's possible. This could be someone who has an emergency at the hospital. They could have, if they're driving recklessly, yeah, they have an emergency. If they're driving really slow, maybe they have like a cake in the front seat that they don't want to spill. Or a goldfish that they don't want to slosh out of his bag or something like that. Okay, I don't know how we got off on that. Okay, so we were talking about shifting in perception in our projections. Okay, so now Master Vasubandhu. This reading's really interesting. If you haven't read it already, take the time to read it. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
It may skip to the next slide. I guess that's what you want to do anyways. Think that you are in a... Oh, you're in a PDF? Oh, I know.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's kind of funky the way it works. We haven't had it that long.
To full screen.
We have it in full screen.
Actually, it's not quite in full screen. There, that should be it. No, that's just going to fit to it. I thought it was Wolfridge.
There's a secret where
it out, though, because I think it's. I always thought it was the timer on the screensaver.
If it's in presentation mode, it should nullify that. But you're right, it normally does that. Computer technician. I can't remember what the hotkey is, though. I can just keep it alive.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so now Master Vasubandhu, he moves on to spiritual proofs. And maybe for us, maybe not, but in general, Americans aren't really attracted to spiritual proofs. There tends to be a lot of resistance and to this sort of proof, and a lot of it's cultural, and so it's good to think about that. If there's resistance, exploring that. What is it? Where is it coming from? Is it something I really believe? Is it just a habit that I've picked up? So the main point is that we're getting to with all these proofs is that there is embargo. We can't prove that there's not. And what Geshe Michael says is we can't prove that there's not because there happens to be one. So how can we prove that this life ends after death? We can't prove that. It takes time to grow in our minds this idea, and it has to cook. And then one day, after we practiced really well, done our retreats, done our meditation, studied, we'll come to see our exact future lives. So we'll come to see them directly, and then we'll know at that point. At this point, we do have to rely on the scriptural proofs, on logical proofs, which the logical proofs can work pretty well for us. The scriptural proofs, the longer we study and the more faith or experience that we have with the teachings and the more we see how they speak to our lives, how they are true in our own experience, then we can start to believe these other proofs that we can't see yet or these other ideas that we can't see yet. We have a lot more faith in them. And at this point, we can't really say, I know there's future lives, unless we've seen them. I haven't seen them. So if we haven't seen them, we can't say we know for sure. We can say, it seems to make a lot of sense to me, and that's what I believe. But we can't say for sure, because we don't know yet. Okay. So say, Sipa Dun Tempe Do.
Sipa Dun Tempe Do.
Sipa Dun Tempe Do.
Sipa Dun Tempe Do.
Okay. So this one, this scriptural proof, is that the Buddha taught that there are seven types of beings, and one of them is a bardo being. So that's one of the scriptural proofs. So if we accept the Buddha's omniscience, then we must accept that there are bardo beings. And among Buddhists, this one is a good reason to accept it. We studied why this is the case in Master Dharmakirti's class. So if we have the Buddha teaching in all his years and we cannot find a single time where he lied, then that's part of the proof that this would be true. Because then he wouldn't be lying here as well. And then Master Vasubandhu gets into another proof, which is the three conditions needed for human birth. Yeah. So say ma room, datsun den. Ma room, datsun den. And then we'll go through all the steps first. Say pama chak.
Pama chak.
Shing trepa.
Shing trepa.
Orisa newar.
Orisa newar.
Nepa.
Nepa.
So that is so interesting, isn't it? Some of the words just do not sound like they're part of the language. I mean, I don't know. I don't speak Tibetan, so maybe that's part of it. Okay. So these are the three conditions needed for human birth. So you need a woman who has a physical body that's capable of birth and is still menstruating. The father and the mother have desire and they make sexual contacts. And then the third is that a bardo being must be in the immediate vicinity of the parents when they're having sex. Isn't it?
It's like the physical space. Like, what do they mean by vicinity?
We'll talk about it a little bit more, but yeah, okay. Basically. Mm-hmm. I know. So these three have to be present when a human is born into a womb. So there has to be a woman fit to give birth, the mother and father have sexual desire, then there has to be the bardo being nearby when they're having intercourse.
So I was there with my parents?
Yep. So because these above statements are made in scripture spoken by the Buddha, this is considered a proof of bardo existence. We'll go into this more a little bit later, explain it more. So this is the basis of scriptural proof, is basically that the Buddha taught it.
So, let's say, do we choose our parents?
I'm interested.
Maybe we're adopted.
Yes, you choose your parents. Mm-hmm. The bardo being chooses. Yeah. But, I don't know if it's that cut and dry, because it's also said that you have a strong karmic connection. So I think that connection would go both ways. So, but basically, yeah, the bardo being picks. And I think these scriptural proofs are maybe not as satisfying to us, but they are true and it's good to think about it. We'll talk more about that in a minute too, about the three. Okay, and then say Bardor Dava.
Bardor Dava.
So this is another proof. The Buddha taught that you can enter Nirvana from the Bardo. So I think maybe Belinda does. Who knows? The definition of nirvana.
Oh, I thought you were asking.
You know?
Oh, me, yes.
Do you know?
Definition of nirvana.
Cessation of mental affliction under the influence of bodhicitta. Well, no, because you don't necessarily
have that to. That first half is right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cessation of mental afflictions brought about, do you remember the rest?
I don't.
By the individual analysis. Mm. which is basically seeing what we kind of coin emptiness directly or ultimate reality directly, how things are really working in the world, directly in meditation. You're seeing it for yourself. So that's what brings on the ending of mental afflictions or suffering, basically jealousy, anger, unhappiness, pride, all those things. So that it's not, he's not talking about full enlightenment, which would need what you mentioned, which was bodhicitta, or that wish to get out of suffering for the sake of all living beings, so that we can help them to do the same. And how did the Buddhas help?
So what's nirvana again?
By teaching. So they can only help by teaching.
The definition of nirvana again is you said the no more mental afflictions.
Mm-hmm.
On a,
brought about by seeing emptiness directly, basically.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that's like that was the start, the beginning of the end was seeing emptiness directly. Beginning of the end of suffering.
So like you said, can you find the time you see emptiness as well? Like, is there like a moment, or is something like gradual?
Are you talking about
emptiness?
The emptiness of seeing emptiness directly? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's the same, in my understanding, it's the same thing as time. If you're dividing the moments further and further and further and further down, you can't find an exact point. Experientially, yep, there's a point where you're seeing emptiness directly and where you're not. So the same thing with time, you know.
Anything, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's a time when I was outside this room and a time when I'm inside this room. But if we break down the time where I'm like stepping over the threshold further and further and further, there's no findable point where, you know, that exactly happened. So, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I was asking.
Yeah.
So, is nirvana, because I always think of it like direct perception of emptiness, nirvana, enlightenment, but maybe I should be thinking of it more like is it an experiential like event that happens, or is it more like the category names after you have the direct perception of emptiness? Like,
you mean, are you in nirvana right when you have the direct perception of emptiness? No, not yet, because permanent cessation of mental afflictions, because you're still cleaning those out.
Okay.
They're still going to come up when you come out of the meditation.
Yeah.
You're still going to have anger or these things arise, but now you have the wisdom to not follow them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still there until they clean out, until you purify.
Okay.
Or they, you know, or they come up enough and,
yeah,
and none of them are left, or they're all damaged beyond being able to function and come up ever again.
So would it be something that, like, would we say it, like, happens in a meditation, or it's more like after my last mental affliction ceases, like, now I'm in nirvana?
I don't know if it would happen in a meditation. I've never heard that answered. I've always thought about it the other way. But I don't know that there's a reason that I've always thought about it like that. I don't believe I've been taught that specifically. So I don't really know about that one. Would it happen in meditation? It kind of seems like it would, but I can't answer for sure.
Yeah.
May I ask?
Mm-hmm.
Can. Does that mean that you can enter nirvana from other? Okay.
Yep. So this is saying that it is possible to enter nirvana from this in-between state, from the state where you're at after you die, before your next rebirth. And I think what we're talking about here, yeah, so the Buddha's taught that there's five situations where you can enter nirvana. And Bardor Dava, which is what we're talking about here, is one of them. And so the point here too is, should we wait for that point to reach nirvana? We can do it in this lifetime. We can reach full enlightenment in this lifetime. Should we wait until we're in this in-between state where we're probably not going to be thinking as clearly? We're what?
Only if we don't reach it in this lifetime.
Yeah, only if it's like the last resort. Because
yeah.
I think it is taught that, and you'll talk to people like this. I've heard people say this sort of thing. Yeah, where they're waiting for death and this in-between time to reach the goal of the path.
Like there's no stress now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like calmness about it.
I know. It's like calmly being led to slaughter, basically. Because
yeah.
We're all slowly marching towards death. So in that state, we're not going to be thinking that clearly. It's not, you know, it's just, and there's a time when, you know, from death and we're transitioning, where there's a point where we can reach awakening. And that's probably the worst situation. Now we have good food to eat. We have comfortable life. We have sharp mind. We're young enough to think and to want to study. It's the perfect time now. We just have to do it now and not put it off. It is good to know that if
we
didn't make it,
there,
yeah,
just in case.
That we at least have a chance there too. So now's the best time to do it. And the chances that we can do it are really good. So the reason it says nirvana here, the reason we're talking about nirvana, does anyone know why it would say nirvana?
Because you cannot become enlightened when you're, dead.
Maybe.
You can, right? I don't know.
Because we're studying from the Abhidharma Kosha, which is what kind of text? What school is this text from? Well, from basically Hinayana school.
Oh.
Yep. So different goal. It's a different school. That's why we're using this proof, because it's from the Abhidharma Kosha. Which doesn't mean it's not valid or really helpful, but in our lineage, we have a little, our goal is a little bit different.
So if a Mahayana Buddhist read it, it would say Buddhahood or enlightenment?
No, I don't think it would. Because if I'm remembering correctly, I think it's Master Vasubandhu who, like, he dissed the other schools. He was actually a Mahayana practitioner, and I think he dissed the other schools, and this was, like, his way of cleansing that and making up for it for himself, for this, you know, and for the sake of others, was to write all of these texts, which is, the Abhidharma Kosha is humongous. So, I don't think it would, because I think this was a different turning of the wheel when the Buddha was teaching.
Okay.
So he was teaching about mostly the Bardo teachings, from what I understand, are in the Abhidharma Kosha, the different school, until we get into the Tantric teachings.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them in Tibetan Buddhism, we don't really go over these teachings unless we're studying the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is from a different school too. In our lineage, it's more, they're more secret teachings. Is that clear? Okay. So we'll just go for another minute or two and then we'll take a break. So the point that we were talking about in not waiting is that there are teachings that you may hear that say to wait for that time after you die. But like we said, not a good idea. Do it now while we have this amazing opportunity. It's a really long shot after we die. I think the idea is that there's some idea that it's a shortcut or something like that. But I just can't imagine that it would be easier in that state. And it's the same thing that Geshe Michael is saying here. Okay, I think this is a good time. Let's take our break now. Maybe take we usually take 10. Okay, let's see where we are here. So we kind of went over this before, but so Master Vasubandhu, he talks about, this is kind of an objection that people give. So he's addressing another objection. He talks about if you commit one of the 5 immediate misdeeds. Does anyone remember what they are?
Killing.
Who? It's called a different. Killing, what'd you say?
Your
mother, father.
Giving us a wish for
not part of this list. Mother, father. 2 more killings. A Buddha and Arhat. And then splitting the Sangha. Which in this one, for the 5 immediate misdeeds, it means the direct followers of the Buddha. So we cannot commit that one. It's always nice when there's one we can't commit. So, if you do one of these 5 immediate misdeeds, you immediately take rebirth in the lowest hell. So, someone's bringing this up and saying, hey, it said that you immediately take rebirth in the lowest hell. So, that doesn't line up with what we're talking about here. And it's because the bardo isn't considered a rebirth. It's not among the 5 types of beings' rebirths. So you still go through the bardo in this case. So there's no problem there. There's no contradiction. So when they say no other rebirth, they aren't talking about the bardo. It's not a separate rebirth. And then there's a question. So why wouldn't Master Vasubandhu just say, give the reason that he's seen the bardo, and that's a proof? Because he is an Arya. But in Buddhism, it's taught that it's not, personal experience is not a proof. It's not a good reason to give someone about why something's true. Why do you think that would be? Why is it not a good reason to give people?
I'm sorry, can you rephrase it?
So it's said that it's not a good reason to give your personal experience. So,
because even if you tell somebody it's not, going to get them there, it could, freak them out, or...
Yeah. It's not going to help them because they can't prove that.
Yeah.
They can't prove that what you're saying is true. It's not helping them logically get to the conclusion. Unless you're an enlightened being and they know that and you're telling them. But in this situation, according to this teaching, Master Vasubandhu isn't an enlightened being yet. So it's not a proof because we're supposed to communicate based on things that people can confirm as well, like we were talking about earlier. In general, it's also true that someone who has had high spiritual realizations, they're not going to say it. They'll never say that they've had that sort of experience. Because in general, it just doesn't help. And I haven't had these sorts of experiences, but from what I've heard the masters say, it's the nature of that sort of experience. So when you see ultimate reality the first time in meditation, it's just not something that you're going to tell anybody about. It's just not something that you talk about.
Besides your teacher?
Maybe.
Or you sometimes don't tell a teacher?
I think I've heard teachings where you do. But maybe it's, maybe the teacher knows too.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they just already know too. So, I think the story I've heard is where, I can't remember who told this story, but where a student had that experience. Maybe it was Keshe Michael, someone else told this story. I don't know. And they just left like a diamond on the altar as like a sign to their teacher. Because the diamond's supposed to be the closest thing to that direct experience that's in the material world. And so that's how he communicated it. So he didn't actually tell their teacher. Okay, so that's a little side trip. And now we're going to go into more about the Bardowas. Who are the Bardowas?
The Bardo beings.
Yep. They're the beings in the Bardo. So what do the Bardowas look like? The outward appearance is like the realm that they'll be born in. So if you're going to be born in human realm, you're going to look like human. If you're going to be born in a hell realm, you'll look like one of the hell beings. If you're going to be born an animal, you'll look like an animal. And their body is made of very subtle matter, very subtle physical matter. And the reason that you'll look like the birth that you're going to take is because it's the same karma that's projecting you through the Bardo as is projecting you into your next life. If you wanted to know how someone is going to be reborn and you had the ability to go to the Bardo, you could look at their Bardo form and you'd know. Then the scriptures give the colors of the Bardo beings too. So the hellbound beings are the color of charred, scorched, or burnt piece of wood. Animal-bound beings are grayish color like smoke. Craving spirits are translucent color like water. And a human or desire realm, devas, appear as 5 or 6 year olds with golden bodies. Then form realm beings appear as clothed adults. And the reason is because you can't be born in that realm unless you have a high degree of modesty. And so you would have the karma to see yourself appearing with clothes on. Then formless realm bound beings have no appearance at all. I think this is the last. A Bardowa's lifespan is a maximum of 7 days. So you spend a maximum of 7 days in that Bardowa life. And then Master Vasumitra, who wrote the most famous commentaries on Master Vasubandhu, this is his view, that the maximum span is 7 days. And it's the most accepted one. The shortest view is said a few seconds. And if you reach the end of 7 days and you haven't taken rebirth, then you die and take another rebirth as a Bardowa. And you can do this 7 times. So 7 times 7 is what? 49. So the maximum total time that you can be in the bardo is 49 days.
49 days?
Mm-hmm.
Or years?
Days. So you must, according to Buddhism, take a rebirth within 49 days. And the day of death counts as one.
But it's not the same as our conception of, I mean, the West conception of dying, death. I mean, wouldn't die at the same time? Is that the
how
concept
do you mean?
Of dying in Tibet is different, or in Buddhism is different from the Christian one? No, it's the same.
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't studied the Christian idea of the death process. Is that what you're referring to?
No, is that somewhere I read that when we die, the body doesn't have any, you know, like signs of being alive, but it's not really dead.
You mean the body that's in, that we're going to leave when we die?
No, this one. The one that I'm, let's say I die right now.
Yeah.
And I have a heart attack and I'm dead.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that Buddhists say that at that moment you're not dead. You die like later on when your ashes, when you're...
There is a period of time where consciousness would stay with the body, but it varies. And so... I can't remember what the exact amount of time is that you're not supposed to move the body. It's maybe 2 or 3 days, or I think it can be up to 2 weeks.
Longer than, I know when, because Venerable Tenzin did the Death and Dying Weekend, and I'm trying to remember how long it was, but I'm thinking it was a couple of weeks or longer.
Was the total, or the,
yeah.
like the maximum.
But that if you did have to move the body, then you want to tap on the crown to encourage the consciousness to leave the body.
Yeah, so...
Okay.
Geshe Soltram taught on this too. I don't remember if he taught on it here, but I think maybe it was Venerable Tenzin who was telling the story. No, but I can't remember which one. But anyways, they had said that it's very clear when the life leaves the body too. So you'll be sitting in the room with the person after it appears they've passed away. They're not breathing anymore. And there'll be a point where you can very clearly tell that they're gone. And that could be in like this time range, which I don't remember exactly what the time range is.
Yeah, and I think Venerable Tenzin also said to check on the body temperature, so on the spot on the back that's just opposite the heart,
mm-hmm.
if they might be, you know, considered medically or clinically dead, if there's still heat there, then all of the elements of the body have not dissolved through,
mm-hmm.
and you have to dissolve through all of the elements before the consciousness reduces.
Mm-hmm. Is that your question?
I thought it was.
So.
It doesn't really matter.
It's
49
days.
Yeah, so the 49 days, they have to take a rebirth within that time. So the day of death counts as day one. And then according to the secret teachings, it's possible to help someone in the bardo through certain kinds of rituals. So don't think that it's superstitious or something to ask a lama to do something. You can ask them to help a being when they've passed away. You would give them their name, the day they died, and it's good to know their birthday as well. So, who can see another bardo being? Can we ever? And the answer is that yes, it is possible to see bardo beings if we get It's called Lei Chen. So say Lei Chen.
Lei Chen.
Which means, translates, Geshe Michael translates it to mean the eye of God. So this means that in deep meditation, you can see the bardo beings. It doesn't mean that a third eye pops up on your forehead. It's not a physical eye. So despite its name, it refers to a deep state of meditation. And there are 11 classic obstacles to developing the Lei Chen. And basically, they're the classical obstacles to meditation. So we're not going to go over all of them. But if you meditate and eliminate the 11 obstacles, then you gain a power to see the bardoas. And then bardoas can see other bardoas of the same class or realm. So if they're headed for a human birth, they can see the other human bardoas. And once you enter the bardo, you can't redirect your rebirth to another realm, because the same karma projects you through and out of the bardo. So you can't enter the bardo headed to the hell realms and then redirect to a human birth. But you could, as we mentioned before, enter nirvana in the bardo and not have to take any rebirth at all. And according to the Abhidharma, that takes place with certain beings headed to the form realm. Okay. And then we name the bardo beings for where they're going. So we call it a human bardo if they're going to the human realm. Or a human bardoa. And then bardoas have miraculous powers. Like they can fly. They can pass through solid objects, walls, they can travel vast distances very quickly. And all of this, all of these ideas are straight from the scripture. They're all in the reading. And there's huge debates in the monastery about how a bardo being can pass through a wall, because two things of physical matter cannot exist in the same place at the same time. But it's said that they can. It's said that they're able to pass through walls. So he just mentions it here. But there is two places, we're starting to get back to Bernardo's question. The bardo beings cannot pass through. One is the physical place where the Buddha was enlightened, under the Bodhi tree in Bodhgaya. And they cannot pass through the tissue of their mother's womb once they get caught in there. This one's interesting. Bardoas live and they live on and they eat smells. We'll get into this in the next class. Basically, we think of sustenance as only what we eat. And we'll get into the different kinds of sustenance in the next class. Some scriptures say that if you're headed for a hell realm, you're walking upside down. If you're headed for a form realm, you're walking slightly upwards in the bardo. Oh, we're almost done. Okay. And the scriptures go through... This part is really sad. There's this prophetic and sad moment where a being gets caught in the womb. So the Abhidharma is usually, in general, it's very dry, but what we've been studying isn't the dry part. Geshe Michael's picked out these different parts that he thinks are like the most important, because we don't have time to study the whole thing. But at this point in the scripture, you feel some sort of sadness, because due to their karma, bardoas are caught in the womb when they see the couple making love from a distance, and they interpret it to be some kind of pleasure, and they move closer to join in. So they think, oh my gosh, look, this amazing thing is happening. I want to participate. And so they move closer, And they have a hallucination where they see sex as something wonderful and glorious, and they go closer and closer. And then they go into the womb where, because of their perceptions that they have, they get trapped and they can't get out. So, it does sound very sad. Their perception changes and they see solid tissue which they can't pass through. And their perception of themselves and the world shifts, and they become locked into that existence or rebirth or perceptual reality. And the attraction to these particular parents are because you have a deep, deep relationship in the past, as we mentioned before. Your karma drives you to this place, and you're particularly attracted to these two beings. The karma ripens, and then it continues to propel them along that way of seeing things. So once in the bardo, you're looking for your next birth, you're being driven towards it. Because like we said, you can't choose a different birth at that point. So you're pushed towards it. So you could say in a way that you're choosing your parents, but it's almost as though you have no choice because it's this strong karma that's drawing you towards them. Which isn't the same as we're going through our lives that we don't have a choice. Because we do. We have the choice in how we react, but we're talking about a different situation. And basically, that's the life of a Bardoa. So it is, it makes it sound incredibly sad. You think that there's this amazing, joyful thing happening and you want to participate and you go closer and you're trapped. You're completely trapped. Everything solidifies around you. So it paints a different picture of being in the womb, really. And it's not that, it's the suffering over and over and over, the cycle of suffering over and over, of birth, life, death, over and over and over and over. So when you read or you hear about stories of enlightened beings being born, it's not the same thing. They're not even really being born, but emanating as being born to teach in some way. It's not the same thing. So it's kind of like the whole cycle of suffering where we're stuck, we're kind of trapped in it until we can practice enough, we can plant enough good seeds, get a strong enough practice where we can basically launch ourselves out of the cycle of suffering, get on that conveyor belt irrevocably out of it. So we can't go back.
I don't understand, if we've been every being's mother, every being has been our mother, then what's kind of the nature of the karmic imprint when they're saying it's stronger and that you would be driven towards these beings?
Yeah, in my understanding, it's that you've had close relationships with them in close past lives.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know for sure about this. This is just what I'm thinking right now. Even if all beings have been our mothers, it doesn't necessarily mean that we've... maybe some beings have been our mothers many, many times, or in relation to us many times,
mm-hmm.
Tons and tons and tons, and then there's others who have only been every relationship once or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that that's the case, but
okay, yeah.
But just thinking aloud right now, that could be the case too. Because there is, even in our, just in our everyday life, we have strong karmic connections with certain people. We can feel them. We're strongly drawn to certain people and really adverse to certain people, which means we have a strong karmic connection with them, both of them. And some people we could care less. We have no, even if we really want to, we want to be really kind or have like warm feelings towards them. There's just nothing there. I have, there's someone like that at work for me. And this person's really sweet. Like, there's nothing wrong with this person, but they come up and they ask me for something, and something comes up, I just don't want to help them. I just don't want to. And I try, you know, I do whatever I can to overcome it and to not act on it. But some of it comes across just because people are perceptive and they can tell. But it's just something comes up, and it's, I've known this person for maybe 5 months, and they're very pleasant in general. It's just something comes up when they come in and talk to me.
Probably a
Buddha. Yeah. So that's my thinking on it. But I believe that's what I've heard, is that they've been really close to us and really near for, yeah, recent lives. Yeah. Look at that one. Reading real quick. I think we'll end with a meditation. We have a short time for that. So we're halfway through. I think we were, we were talking about the continuum earlier, and why, if things were a continuum, it couldn't just stop at one point and pick up immediately somewhere else and still be a continuum. There would have to be like some thread continuing through. Does that feel like something that you could think about more, or, you know, that we could do an analytical meditation on, or does it seem pretty clear in your mind?
Well, it seems, to me, it seems pretty clear.
Okay. Yeah.
But,
me too.
I don't like it very much, though.
It's clear, but I dislike it intensely. Okay. The meditation and the homework is 15 minutes per day, imagining how it will be to enter the Bardo realms as you die. Let's try that. So we'll just, how it will be to enter the Bardo realms as you die. So we'll do just a short meditation. And so just sitting up tall, relaxing back into your body again for a few minutes, for a few moments, letting go of maybe a lot of energy up in the head. Let all of the tension go. And as with all of the ideas and teachings, just approaching it with a soft heart, with a sense of curiosity and investigation. So it's more of exploring, looking into different ideas and seeing how they land for us. And we may all have different points that we're starting from. So wherever you're starting from, if there was a bardo state after we die, if that were true, maybe we believe it is, maybe we're not sure, maybe we don't. But if it were, based on what we've learned, what might that transition look like? What might the transition from death into the bardo look like? And so we'll sit with that for a few minutes. And you can actively analyze it, look at it from all different sides, or you can go into it more experientially. And just imagine what that experience might be like. I'm starting to let go of the meditation, bringing it to a close wherever you're at. Getting a sense that you're offering all of the energy from this meditation, from coming to class, all the karmic seeds you planted, And as we do our closing prayers, offering it with our deepest understanding of emptiness and karma to reaching full awakening for the benefit of all beings.
Sashi
Pugi Shukshing Meto Tram Riradling Shin Yen De Gampadi Sange Shing Nu Mete Wagi Drogun Amda Shing La Chupashok Yidam Guru Radha Mandala Kanirya Sayami
Dewa
Di Gewo Kun Sunam Yeshe Sok Sok Shri Sunam Yeshe Lejun Le Tampa